Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with attorney Katie Rand from Pierce Atwood. She is going to be talking about three Supreme Court case decisions that are going to make a huge impact in HR and the business community. So, Katie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. You know, I got to tell you, sometimes people would say they're going to go, oh my God, we're going to be talking about Supreme Court cases. Please do not allow your head to hit the steering wheel, because you are not going to fall asleep on this, I promise, all right? But these are important things. They're really, really important. The first case, been all over the news, has to do with DOMA, right? The Defense of Marriage Act. And it's United States versus Windsor. Can you set the stage for this, how this whole thing came about?
Yeah, well, let's start with DOMA itself, which is, that's a federal law that was enacted in the 90s when Clinton was president. And at that time, no state recognized same-sex marriage. But Congress saw it coming, the tide was turning. And what Section 3 of DOMA, and that's the section that the Supreme Court addressed, does is it says regardless of whether people are married lawfully under state law, for federal purposes, marriage means man and a woman, regardless of whether the states authorize same-sex marriage or not. And there are about 1,300, more than 1,300 federal laws that, you know, dictate benefits. You know, one that's probably really familiar to the listeners is the FMLA, for example. So, benefits are available, leave is available for a spouse with a serious health condition. Well, under DOMA, regardless of whether that spouse was a legal spouse, if they were a same-sex spouse, no leave. So that's DOMA. These parties got to the Supreme Court. It was two women that were married in Ontario. They were lawfully wed. They moved to New York, and one of them died and left her entire state to her spouse. And when the surviving spouse tried to take advantage of the estate tax exemption, she was unable to do so and got hit with a huge tax bill. She paid it, and then she sued. And that's sort of how this case
was teed up. So all this came about because of a tax bill.
That's right. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It was probably a pretty big tax bill.
I would think it was pretty big, yes. Yeah. All right. So, DOMA, you've set the stage. This is the law. It's a federal law. Went into place. It's been in place for 10...
More, since the 90s.
Since
yeah,
the 90s. Okay. It's almost 15, 20 years. She sued. She went up through the ranks. Did she win anywhere on her way to the Supreme Court before it got there? Did she lose on her way up? What happened?
The Supreme Court actually affirmed the Court of Appeals. What it held was that Congress is not entitled to single out this class of marriages that the states say are legal marriages, single them out for, second-class treatment, basically. That's what the Supreme Court said. And so, there are other cases pending other places. This Windsor case made its way to the Supreme Court. There have been other cases pending in other jurisdictions challenging DOMA as well. The First Circuit, which is the circuit that the main courts report up to, similarly held that DOMA was unconstitutional. So the stage has been set for this for a long time.
So what are some of the results of this in terms of, the definition of marriage now is two individuals? What do they say now is the change that has to happen in terms of, because we know what it said marriage was.
Yep.
Is there a redefinition? Is there, could it be two men, two women, other entities? I mean, is this, what's the definition now today?
So what this new decision means is, what the Supreme Court said is historically states have always decided what it means to be marriage and to be married, and they haven't always agreed. Interracial marriage to first cousins, for example, the states have disagreed on those things, and never has the federal government intervened and said, regardless of what you say, for federal purposes, this is what marriage means. So after this decision, the impact of the decision is that the federal government can't do that, and it has to respect for federal purposes what the states say marriage means. And so the impact of the decision will be more or less depending on whether you're operating in a state where same-sex marriage is legal.
Will it change if somebody moves from state to state?
Yeah, that is a huge question left unanswered by Windsor. If a couple is married legally in a state that allows same-sex marriage and moves to a state that does not, whether that marriage is a valid marriage for federal purposes is an open question.
So that was not answered in this?
Not answered.
How about if somebody is living in Maine, for example, and works in Massachusetts? And let's say that there's a difference between the two in terms of that.
Possibly the same issue, depending on the statute. So that I keep going back to the FMLA because that's more interesting than the tax code and ERISA from my perspective.
No question.
And just easier for some people to get their head around. The FMLA regulations actually say that whether somebody is a spouse is determined by their domicile, which in plain speak means where they live. So arguably for FMLA purposes, whether they're married and entitled to leave under federal law depends on where they live. But then we have all these state laws, as you know, that govern leave as well. So it's never that simple.
No, it isn't. So employees have to look at their definitions of what they're currently doing and probably consult to try to determine what they have to do, especially if they're, for example, in 10, 15 states across the country. I can just imagine that they would have to have different rules and regulations for every state.
Yeah, that's sort of an open question, too. Yeah, I think, and the implications for benefits are probably where it's greatest. And you know, so employer-provided health benefits, for example, those now being available to same-sex spouses in places that authorize that. So there are all kinds of implications. It's a little bit of a mess, but it will sort itself out as time goes on.
Are there any tax implications for this in terms of, you know, from the sense of, you know, same-sex spouses are eligible for different federal tax
Absolutely.
Processes? And
Absolutely.
Things?
Just like Windsor, the woman who brought this case up, for example, if she were living in a state where same-sex marriage was lawful, then there would have been an estate tax exemption available to her, and there will be moving forward. So in a real sense, she won that case for herself and for anyone else that's in her situation.
So employees are going to look at what the state laws are before they necessarily move there. For example, if a company wants to relocate somebody from Boston to Texas, huge differences between the laws between the two states, for example, this could be a factor in getting somebody to move.
Perhaps, you know, though this is in some ways post Windsor, things are simplest for employers who live in or who operate in states that do authorize same-sex marriage, because then state law requires them to do certain things with respect to these same-sex couples, and now federal law will treat them consistently. It was really employers operating in those states that allowed same-sex marriage, but DOMA was, you know, had a different definition for federal purposes that really mucked things up, I would say.
Okay. Now, currently, the information I have is that 13 states and the District of Columbia currently recognize same-sex marriage. And certainly there are plenty more states currently looking at that law.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you see that may be areas where we've talked about some unanswered questions, but other areas that may be unanswered questions at this time?
Well, I think the other major open question at this time is whether this repeal of DOMA operates only prospectively, forward-looking, or whether it actually has retrospective application. And that's what the lawyers are chatting about online, and that's...
Now, the court did not address that in
correct.
Its decision?
That's right.
Just a general question having to do with the Supreme Court, and we hear a lot on the news, we hear a lot on, you know, from sources. Do they normally not answer a lot of questions? You know, it's just, it would seem if you're going to make a big decision that you may provide a little more guidance to attorneys and so forth to kind of figure out what exactly it is that they want done.
Yeah, that's a good question. Lawyers understand why they don't do that, but you know, generally people don't. You're right. They don't answer questions typically unless they absolutely have to. And there's actually a good reason for that. One is that they're they're there only to answer the controversies that are put before them. Another is illustrated well by this DOMA case. Society changes. Things change over time. And so to the extent they can avoid creating precedent and locking themselves in an area where things may evolve, they want to do that. And the other reason is that precedent, you know, this concept of cases, you know, establishing the law, that's a very firm concept, and courts are extremely reluctant to overrule themselves. So if they can leave the question for another day, they always will.
So you said there are more cases coming up having to do with this across the country. Do you think there'll be another challenge to the Supreme Court on this, or a different variation of it?
Well, this answers the question of whether this Section 3 of DOMA, you know, which is this federal definition of marriage, is lawful. There may be challenges to Section 2 of DOMA, which talks about whether states have to recognize other states' same-sex marriages. And there may be, you know, other challenges to what the states are doing to pass mini DOMAs. There are states, many states, that have their own version of DOMA, which is, you know, marriages between a man and a woman. And so probably the next really big challenge, and I don't know that this is coming anytime soon because this is bigger than DOMA, is whether the Constitution provides a right for same-sex individuals to marry. That's DOMA. This Windsor decision does not answer that question, whether there's a constitutional right for same-sex people to marry. So right now, states can still prohibit same-sex marriage and restrict it to a man and a woman.
And 37 states currently have DOMA-like laws.
Well, 37 states do. I think that's about right. Have laws that somehow restrict it. Some, you know, do that through statute or constitution. But whether that's a right that's guaranteed by the Constitution is an open question. You know, just like interracial marriage made its way through the Supreme Court, you know, this question, I'm sure, will someday make its way there.
It's interesting when you really look at this. There's so many levels to such a, what you would see as a simple decision. Yes, that's the answer. Mm. But there is a lot more to this in terms of trying to understand from an employer standpoint or an HR professional's standpoint what they have to do and what they have to understand is the law of each state. And in a sense, I guess it actually made it a little more complicated than it used to be because you had one statute for all 50 states federally, period. Yep. That's what it was. Now you have to look to, you know, 50 states' rules and regulations, and it makes it a little more confusing and a little more of a challenge for employers to figure out what is it in my state that I have to look at. Not that there's any different to anything else, I suppose.
No, I think that's probably right. And at least if you're in a state that authorizes same-sex marriage, you now know that that definition holds true for all purposes, federal and state. And well, similarly, if you're in a state that doesn't.
So if you're, one last question having to do with, if your company is headquartered in a state, California, doesn't matter where, is it best for the organization to think about just running it based on what the headquarters does across all platforms all over the country, or do you still have to go by state rules?
If you operate in a state where same-sex marriage is legal, you could choose to provide certain benefits to those employees in every state, even where same-sex marriage isn't legal. In other words, you could choose to provide more than the other state's laws require. But for federal purposes, for federal benefits purposes, those employees in states where same-sex marriage is not lawful are still not going to be married for federal purposes. So the federal government is still going to look to what each state How they define marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was very interesting topic. See, I told you it wouldn't be boring. This is great stuff. Yeah. Katie, we're going to be right back in a few seconds. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know, it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you frustrated with medical care today? Does it make you angry that your doctor spends more time looking at the computer screen than at you? Does it seem like your doctor is out the door in 5 minutes? There is a better alternative. At Champy Family Practice, Dr. Michael Champy and his dedicated staff make taking care of patients their priority. They are a cash-friendly direct pay practice, which is the perfect option for people with no insurance, high deductibles, and health savings accounts. Unlike other practices, they post their prices in the office and even online. Get modern medical care delivered the old-fashioned way. For more information, call ChampyFamilyPractice.com. That's C-I-A-M-P-I. Or call 774-1222. Champy Family Practice is located at 380 Lincoln Street in South Portland. Champy Family Practice, continuing a tradition of medical excellence in Greater Portland since 1959.
And we are back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking with Katie Rann, partner over at Pierce Atwood, Attorneys at Law. You know what, Katie? It's interesting. We went through the first discussion about the Supreme Court decision having to do Dilmar in the last segment and learned a lot, actually, from your take on it. Tell me about the second case, which inevitably looks like, to me, a big win for employers. The University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus NASA.
Yeah, there's no question that this is a big win for employers. What it comes down to, what the issue in the case, is about what a plaintiff has to prove to show that she was retaliated against. And so Title VII, which is the federal law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, sex, basically says that you cannot discriminate against someone, quote, because of their race, color, national origin. And, you know, leave it to lawyers to argue about what the word because means. But there are all kinds of decisions that talk about what because means. And that's what this case is about. What does it mean? What does because mean in the context of retaliation?
And so what was the court's decision on what the word because means?
I can't explain it in two words, so I have to kind of take a step back.
Okay.
Many years ago, the court held that in the context of discrimination, because means that, and I'll use race, just needs to be a motivating factor. So even though an employer fired an employee for productivity reasons, for example, if race was also a motivating factor, the employer could be liable. And they could be liable even if they could show that they would have fired them without the race, just for the performance issues. In response to that, Congress amended Title VII to make it clear that in the context of discrimination, it's enough to show that race, color, national origin, sex was a motivating factor. It's been an open question whether this motivating factor standard applies to retaliation, which is a little bit different than discrimination.
Right.
So in a retaliation case, the employee's arguing, the plaintiff is arguing that they were terminated or suffered some other adverse employment action because they opposed a practice unlawful under Title VII or participated in a proceeding under Title VII, like filed an EEOC charge, for example. Ultimately, Congress never amended the language in the retaliation provisions to make it clear that because meant a motivating factor. And the court said, therefore, because means because in the context
now
of retaliation.
Now, there's a profound
That's
statement.
Right.
Because means because.
It means but for.
Okay.
So a plaintiff, after this Nassar case, has to show that they would not have been terminated, for example, but for their protected activity. Not just that the protected activity was a motivating factor, but that it was the reason, the motivating factor. This makes a difference because it makes retaliation cases a lot more difficult to prove.
So let's take this. Let's give some numbers behind this because I think what I'd like to do is two parts. I'd like to talk about, you know, how big an issue really is this? You know, what are we talking about? Maybe from some stats of what's going on. And then the second would be maybe if you could provide an example or two of how this in the real world mm-hmm. would actually be seen, or how, you know, what would happen. Mm-hmm. So if you could do, let's first talk about the numbers. And, you know, I know you have some numbers here. How many cases of retaliation are currently happening, and is it up or down?
It's up significantly. And I can say that from my own practice, even just over the 10 years that I've been practicing, I have seen an uptick every single year. And I know that it's up because the EEOC says it's up. And so in 2000, apparently roughly 19,600 claims of retaliation were filed with the EEOC. In 2012, that was almost 38,000. So in 2012, almost 40% of all claims filed with the EEOC alleged retaliation. That's just huge.
Yeah, that's a huge jump.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about this, let's give an illustration. Tell me a little bit about an example of how this would come about.
Retaliation claims generally.
Yes.
Two ways. They come about when an employee files a charge against their employer, so files a charge with the EEOC or the Maine Human Rights Commission or some state agency. And in that case, it's very easy to identify that the employee has engaged in protected activity, right? But they also come about when an employee complains about something that is unlawful under Title VII. And so that means when they complain about discrimination or about harassment. It can be less clear that an employee is complaining about discrimination or harassment because they may not use the words hostile work environment or discrimination. Or they may use those words, hostile work environment. I think everybody, every listener is probably familiar mm-hmm. with an employee using the word hostile work environment when what in fact is going on is not a hostile work environment at all. In that way, it can be harder to pinpoint the complaint protected activity, but that's how it comes up.
So you have this complaint, it's filed, somebody feels retaliated against for filing the complaint, either through, you know, the person who was being charged with this or the employer itself, correct? Mm-hmm. Saying that they feel that, you know, we're feeling pressure because we filed this complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So the retaliation happens. Can you maybe provide an example of a case? And it doesn't, obviously, you can leave out the names to protect the guilty or innocent in this case. And maybe explain how the difference in standards works this way.
Yeah. Often, you know, just to set the stage for a case, you know, when an employee files a charge or complains, the employer does not and should not be hands off and all of a sudden stop managing that employee's performance or addressing issues in their productivity or, you know, other performance issues, conduct issues.
And I think that's important because sometimes employers think that, oh my God, they filed a claim, I have to put kid gloves on at this point, correct? I mean, they do. They get very nervous.
They do, and it's appropriate to be nervous, and it's appropriate to look very carefully at how you're managing the employee, but it's not fair to the rest of the workforce to just stop managing that employee, right? So they continue managing the employee, and the employee doesn't see it for what it is, which is managing their performance, and sees it as retaliation. And then there's a question of, well, what was it? Was it the performance, or was it the retaliation? The way the difference in standard that the Supreme Court articulated is helpful, or the way it may come up, is in an example like this. An employee is complaining that her coworker, who's male, is constantly talking about his personal life at work, you know, maybe his girlfriends, the dates he's gone on, and she's complaining that this makes her feel uncomfortable and that she's distracted by it and can't do her work. At the same time, the employer is managing the complainer's performance, let's say productivity. She's just not taking enough calls per hour. She's slow. So they're looking into her complaint about her coworker, and they're giving her a written warning and marching her along toward termination for her productivity, and she's fired. From the employer's perspective, she's fired because she's unproductive. The employee says, oh, no, it wasn't because I was unproductive. Clearly, it was because I was complaining about my coworker distracting me with his stories. And that complaint was a complaint of sexual harassment that was protected under Title VII. And so the court or the jury is left parsing what was the motive. If the employee was complaining a lot about her coworker, it may be that there's some evidence that somebody, the supervisor, was annoyed by her complaints. Maybe the supervisor rolled his eyes a few times, like, will you stop complaining about your coworker? So there may be some evidence he was annoyed by that. There's probably also good evidence that she was really unproductive. In that case, there's some risk, if the standard were just a motivating factor, there's some risk that the court or a jury would say, well, yeah, her productivity was terrible, but you were also motivated by the fact that she was complaining, and therefore you're liable. Whereas in this case, with the standard that the Supreme Court's articulated, if the employer can say, yeah, we were annoyed by the complaint, but we would have fired her anyway for being unproductive. Look at all these other people we've fired for being unproductive. Then the employer wins. That makes sense.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is this case, University of Texas Southwest Medical Center in Nassar. Tell me what the actual issue was for that case that brought it forward, because I think it's important to set, you know, to tell people why or what happened to get to this point.
The plaintiff was a physician who worked teaching for the university and also had privileges at a hospital, and the university had an agreement with the hospital to share folks like this. The physician plaintiff claimed that he was being harassed by his supervisor at the university. He was of Middle Eastern descent, and he claimed that she was discriminating against him and making various, you know, discriminatory comments, harassing him. He decided that he wanted to leave the university because of her conduct, but stay on with this hospital. And he wrote a letter basically putting his supervisor's behavior out into the light and saying, I'm leaving the university because this woman is harassing me because I'm Middle Eastern descent. Well, his supervisor's supervisor did not appreciate the fact that he put this woman in a negative light and felt was angry about that. I think that was undisputed. At the same time, there was a question about whether the plaintiff could continue to work at this medical center under the terms of the university's agreement with the medical center. And so this guy reached out to the medical center and said, you should not be employing this guy, this plaintiff. It's not consistent with our agreement. And the medical center withdrew the job offer. And so there were two parallel claims. There was a claim of discrimination and harassment that was premised on the supervisor's discriminatory remarks, and then there was a claim for retaliation based on this guy's interference, alleged interference with his job offer. And so that's how it set the stage, and the court really parsed through, well, there are two different standards for those two different claims.
Excellent. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We'll be right back with another great court case. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
In today's digital age of instant communication, the art of conversation is being lost. Too often, verbal communication is reduced to shouting, not talking. Join me, Steve Woods, also known as Steve-O, for Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, for inspired conversations with extraordinary guests. We'll talk sports, health, green, and life its own self. Catch Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, Saturdays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on News Talk WLOB, AM 1310, streaming live on WLOBradio.com.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're still talking with the very famous Katie Rant.
It's generous.
You're famous. Yeah, you're famous. You're a star on the radio. Look at that. No, she's with Pierce Atwood, great law firm here in Portland and across the Northeast. Talk to me a little bit about this next Supreme Court case. You know, we've done two great cases. This next one is, to me, one of the most important ones, because it defines something that you would think is easily defined, but now is more clear, and that is, who is the supervisor? And this is the case, Vance versus Bale State University. I did notice universities are in a lot of cases here at the Supreme Court. So tell us first what's going on with this case. Why did this come about?
Yeah, the facts of this case are similar to facts that play out in her, you know, they're the stereotypical harassment case. This happened to be a kitchen worker. She was African American, and she alleged that she was being harassed on the basis of race in the kitchen. And the alleged harasser was not the manager of the kitchen or the director of the department, but somebody who worked side by side with her in the kitchen and who directed the workflow. And so this guy didn't have the power to hire employees or fire them or cut their pay or demote them, but directed the workflow in the kitchen. And so the question was whether this person was a supervisor or a coworker.
So the answer is?
The answer is that he's a coworker. But the reason why it's even important whether he's a supervisor or a coworker is employer liability is different depending on that, on the answer to that question, right? So if he's a coworker, then the employer could only be liable for his harassment if it was negligent, if it knew, should have known, did nothing to stop the harassment. Whereas if he's a supervisor, the employer is automatically liable for what he does. It can assert an affirmative defense, basically that it had a great process in place for preventing and correcting harassment and the woman didn't take advantage of it. But it bears the burden of proof on that. So the standards of employer liability are different depending on who they are. And that's why this issue was so important.
Well, this is a huge issue for the HR community.
Yes.
Because defining job descriptions, defining policies and procedures, defining who is a supervisor is a basic thing that must be done in terms of any organization, any structure that you set up. Back when, we had pretty simple setups. You had a hierarchy. You had probably the owner or president. You had some VPs. You had a director. You had a manager, and you had an employee. Today, you have a lot more different titles, shift supervisors and lead men.
Yep, team leads.
Team leads. As you said, line workers that oversee different things. Tell me what the Supreme Court said and how this all now is clearer. What are some of the things that a supervisor has to be?
Yeah, so now a supervisor, the Supreme Court says, has to be somebody that has the authority to take tangible job actions. And that means, that takes us back to the list of things I said this guy couldn't do, which were hire, fire, promote, impact pay. Has to be able to take tangible actions like that with respect to the other employees. It's not enough that this person just sort of directs the work. You're right. The work environment is not as clear. The hierarchy is not as clear anymore, which is why this woman was arguing that's not really fair. That standard that the Supreme Court adopted is not really fair. And in a real world, there are people who can make the work environment miserable. They have enough authority to do that, but they don't have the authority to hire, fire, or make demotions or pay changes, and that the employer should be liable for those people who have enough authority, basically, to harass people mm-hmm. through that authority. But the Supreme Court rejected that, I think, in part because there's virtue to the simplicity of the test that they adopted, which is a really good thing for employers.
So, in this particular case, you mentioned in your original comments to me beforehand that there were some funny things that happened during this case, during the oral arguments. Tell me a little bit about those.
Yeah, I would not say that the Supreme Court is known for its humor, but I listened to the oral argument and read the transcript, and I've played it for groups when I've discussed this issue that I've presented to, because it is pretty funny. The court was basically testing this theory that the plaintiff was putting forth about a supervisor being able to impact the work environment. And I think it was Justice Roberts that said, well, So are you saying that, you know, if an employer gives the most senior employee the authority to control the music all day long, and that employee says, you know, you date me or it's country music all day, you know, is that sufficient? Is that sufficient to make them, you know, a supervisor that's, you know, perpetrating harassment? And the council said, no, no, you know, that wouldn't be severe enough. There's a severity standard, as you know, under hostile work environment. And I think it was Scalia popped in and said, well, what about if it was hard rock all day long? And so they were testing the premise this way. At some point, I think it was Roberts said, well, what if they said you had to cut celery all day instead of baking the bread? Would that be enough? And so there were some signals from the oral argument that the court was not buying this theory, that it was just too squishy for them, this theory that a supervisor is a supervisor if they can direct the work.
So it's pretty clear now what the definition is. What do employers need to do in their day-to-day paperwork, the day-to-day policies? We talked about job descriptions and things like that, to make sure that they've clearly defined what a supervisor is, so there is no question.
Yeah, that's a good question. The term supervisor still means different things under different laws, unfortunately. You know, kind of like independent contractor, you know.
Right.
We've gotten better, but there are still, so the NLRA, for example, has a very different definition of supervisor than the one we now have under Title VII. But to ensure that people who are truly supervisors under this new definition under Title VII are treated that way, then there has to be clarity about what their authority is in their job descriptions and also in practice, probably. You know, I would expect that it just, if a job description gave somebody the authority to do some of these tangible actions, but in practice, in fact, the individual had to run everything up the chain, then there's some risk there that that person's not a supervisor.
So for these line supervisors, for these, I'll call them mid people, who are not really supervisors, but kind of in a supervisory role, does this pose a challenge to them from the standpoint of, what if an employee just goes, look, you're not my supervisor, I'm not going to be following what you say, because you can't possibly affect my life in a way that firing, hiring, or doing anything, so I'm just going to ignore you?
It might. And then that would raise the question, assuming that that person did have the authority to then go up a step and negatively impact that employee's work environment, we may be right back at the Supreme Court in 10 years about the definition of supervisor, because these mid-level people can, maybe not independently, but they can impact the pay and the terms and conditions of other people's employment.
Because their opinions still matter.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Hopefully.
In terms of that. Now, the other thing you mentioned was that states have different definitions of what a supervisor is. Did this decision make any reference to the fact of states' rights versus federal?
No. In some states, different states have different schemes for harassment liability, and some of them differentiate more or less based on whether it's done by a supervisor. Some you know, don't at all. Some have this defense that we talked about, some don't. And it's an open question in a lot of states.
That's great. Well, you know what? We've talked about three Supreme Court cases. What I want to do is come back in the next segment and talk about, hey, litigation is expensive. And the fact is that most companies, most organizations would like to avoid it if possible. So let's talk about how they can do that next segment, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Are you frustrated with medical care today? Does it make you angry that your doctor spends more time looking at the computer screen than at you? Does it seem like your doctor is out the door in 5 minutes? There is a better alternative. At Champy Family Practice, Dr. Michael Champy and his dedicated staff make taking care of patients their priority. They are a cash-friendly direct pay practice, which is the perfect option for people with no insurance, high deductibles, and health savings accounts. Unlike other practices, they post their prices in the office and even online. Get modern medical care delivered the old-fashioned way. For more information, call ChampyFamilyPractice.com. That's C-I-A-M-P-I. Or call 774-1222. Champy Family Practice is located at 380 Lincoln Street in South Portland. Champy Family Practice, continuing a tradition of medical excellence in Greater Portland since 1959.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Katie Rand. Katie, you know, we talked about three great Supreme Court cases that are going to make an impact to the HR community and businesses across the country. But as I said at the end of the last segment, litigation is expensive. I mean, do you have any idea what it might cost to take a court case all the way from your local little level all the way to the Supreme Court? I mean, what would be an average no costs for that?
Oh, my Lord. It depends. And I can tell you it's not rare for it to cost $100,000 to take a case through trial in the trial court. And then you're talking about another two levels of appeals after that. So hundreds of thousands of
dollars. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And I'm sure every organization, every leadership person out there today is saying to themselves, sure, I've got that to spare. Mm. You know, let's make that happen. So let's talk about how to avoid claims first is better. They do happen, and when they do happen, you need to have great representation. There's no question about that, and we'll talk about that in a few seconds. So tell me about some of the areas where HR professionals, business leaders can look to lower their risk and avoid claims.
Okay. Yeah, in addition to having representation being helpful at that litigation stage, it can be helpful to avoiding claims, too. So
absolutely.
You know, let's focus first on harassment because that's sort of where we left off. You know, the keys to avoiding harassment claims are not new, and most HR professionals are familiar with them. It's really practicing them consistently that's the key. So obviously having a good policy and training on that annually. Training that's directed towards supervisors, because those are the people, again, who, if they engage in harassment, the employer's on the hook. And now we know who those people are, right? So let's, you know, some really focused training toward them around what's permissible and what isn't, and the edges of harassment, not just what's clearly harassment, but what the edges of harassment, jokes, that sort of thing, well-intentioned jokes, and how those can be.
Before you go further with that, let's talk about training for just a second. Each state has their own laws and rules about what is required. Maine has a requirement to train. Mm-hmm. Some other, California has now a two-hour requirement of training. And there's different ones across the state. What is a best practice for an organization to train on harassment? Is it yearly? Is it 2 years? Is it, you know, within 90 days of someone starting? Is it a combination of everything? What is your perception of what you think is the right combination?
If you can do annual harassment, it doesn't work for everybody, but if you can do annual harassment training, then that's absolutely the way to go, both because it minimizes claims and because it goes a long way toward showing a court that you take harassment seriously and that you're trying to educate your employees.
Yeah, we've been saying that, and we agree. That's a minimal standard, we think, to really show the court you're serious. The other thing we talk about is when somebody gets promoted from a line or, you know, a sales level and then goes into management, that they do need additional training at that point, because it is a different type of training when you're talking about supervisors, because they need to understand the process and how to handle it and so forth, and the liability issue that they can be held liable for it as well.
That's right. I mean, the supervisors, in addition to being, to employers being automatically liable for what they do, when an employee complains to a supervisor, the employer is deemed to have known about it. So you're right. When you're training supervisors, there's this whole second layer of how to recognize a complaint And again, they're not always that obvious. So how to pick up on something that sounds like a complaint and elevate it and get it handled.
Right, and handle it properly.
Correct.
And make sure that, you know, they're handling it in a confidential manner, that they're getting the information typically in writing and typically partnering with either HR or whatever the process is in their environment to make sure it's held correctly.
Absolutely. And then get a thorough investigation, and then getting back to the individual who complained. There are far too many employers that forget that last step. And so they conclude, for example, maybe that the complaint wasn't substantiated, or, you know, was overblown, and then they fail to circle back, because that's an uncomfortable thing to tell the person who complained, or for whatever reason, people get busy, and that's always bad.
Yeah, and it's to take care of it right away. You know, mm-hmm. we have had situations where supervisors on the Friday before they go on vacation have someone complain to them and go, oh, well, I'll handle it in a week when I return, and who knows what will happen during that week when it blows up.
Yes, that's not prompt. It needs to be prompt.
That's right. Prompt means now.
And doing it, sometimes there are employees who complain more than others. And sometimes the more they complain, the less loud, they're heard less. And so doing it every time, even if, just as well and just as thoroughly every time, even if you don't think there's anything to it.
So we've talked about harassment. How about for the retaliation part? What are some of the things that can be done?
Yeah, retaliation claims are different in that, I think society has moved along. This is not to say that there are no remnants of discrimination in society. I know there are. But we've moved along to a place where I see discrimination a lot less than was probably seen years ago. Retaliation, on the other hand, there's sort of a human tendency when an employee complains about something and the business is on the line, there can be a human tendency to want to hit back. And jurors see that. And I think that's why these cases are really on the rise. So if somebody engages in protected activity, files a charge or complains, if you are able to screen the supervisor from that information, if that's practicable, that's great, because then if the supervisor is continuing to manage performance, there's no question that it was retaliatory. That's often not practicable. And so when it isn't, it's about having really frank, upfront discussions with the people who work with this employee and control their work environment that retaliation's unacceptable and there'll be consequences for it. And then it's actually watching, following up with the employee, watching and seeing what's happening with the employee. If there's discipline or performance management, HR should be pressing on that and independently verifying that it's legit. So I'd say those are sort of the best ways to avoid retaliation claims.
So a lot of what we're talking about is risk mitigation and thinking ahead. What are maybe some tips you can give here that would say, hey, these are maybe three areas that you can look at in your organization and minimize risk?
Yeah. Well, timing is everything. And I think HR professionals are used to, when a termination decision is being made, they're used to running through whether the employee is a member of a protected class, age, religion, that sort of thing, and making sure they're considering that. Less so with retaliation and protected activity. So as a routine matter with any adverse employment action, stopping and thinking about whether the employee has complained about something in recent past. And that doesn't mean that you don't move ahead. It just means you do so mindfully, conscientiously. So that would be one thing, looking for temporal proximity between complaints and adverse employment actions. The other one we already touched on, which is training supervisors. It can't be overstated. I mean, these are the people. Your business is in these people's hands, and they need to be armed with the knowledge to behave appropriately and elevate complaints appropriately.
Yeah, the other part I would add to that, and I think you'll probably agree, is senior leadership, senior management, even at the CEO, senior VP level. Sometimes they haven't been trained on how to handle properly these situations. And it does happen at senior levels, and they, I dare say, sometimes become a little more defensive than others because it's not something that is normally challenged in those levels. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's an area that I would think is very important.
Absolutely. That's absolutely the case. It's not that uncommon, actually, for these things to happen at those levels. And I think part of the reason may be exactly what you just identified, that there isn't the same level of training or understanding, and people are reluctant to hold higher leadership accountable.
Absolutely. And that includes boards, by the way.
Yes,
you know,
it
board
does.
Training is important in that area as well.
Absolutely.
What's the third and final tip?
I touched on this too. Thoroughly investigating complaints, even if you believe they're frivolous. No matter how small the complaint is, giving it the attention that you would a more serious complaint is A, it satisfies a lot of employees, and so things stop there. And B, it's what you need to show you did later when that employee sues.
The last part I'll ask of that is, you know, you talked about making sure you go back to the employee and finish the circle. They're not entitled to know everything, are they?
No. For example, you know, if you choose to take action based on a complaint, you may not share specifically how you've taken action. It may be obvious if the alleged harasser is no longer there anymore, but you may not share. You know, you're not going to give them a copy of the written warning or share those kinds of details. But getting back to them on a high level of, you know, we found your concerns were legitimate, real, and we've taken care of them, and this is going to be the process moving forward with you to assure that this never happens again.
That's great. So, you know, we talked a little bit before. You're over at Pierce Atwood. Pierce Atwood now covers how many states in terms of, you know, legal counsel?
New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Washington, D.C. I may even be leaving one out. We're growing very quickly.
No, that's great. Yeah. That's great. So tell me, your area is?
I'm in the labor and employment group. I do, you know, a sort of a mixture of litigation and advice and counsel. Harassment, discrimination, wage hour, sort of the whole gamut of issues that employers face with their employees.
If somebody was looking to get a hold of you, other than the fact that they will be able to go to the HRPowerHour.com after this segment and be able to get your information directly, but if they wanted to contact your office directly, how would they do so?
And they could call the firm at 207-791-1267 or email or our website, pierceatwood.com, and find, we have all kinds of great attorneys who practice in all sorts of areas, so they can find one of us there.
Perfect. Katie, thank you very much for being on the show today. I appreciate it. I think it gave the listeners a real in-depth insight into Supreme Court decisions and how they do really matter and how they can affect employees and employers across the country. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
And now your HR tip of the week. Here are some tips to prevent sexual harassment lawsuits. First of all, just having a written policy isn't enough. You have to take a proactive approach to ensuring a safe workplace that does not allow for sexual harassment or retaliation against those who report it. Couple of additional tips. Implement a written policy prohibiting harassment or discrimination of any kind, including sexual harassment. Employees, customers, and suppliers are all protected against harassment and retaliation. Monitor the policy to make sure everyone is adhering to it. Identify any trends occurring in specific departments or with specific employees, and be prepared to address each report appropriately. This has been your HR Tip of the Week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Kathy Kilroy. She is the president and co-founder of the Mentor Group, Incorporated out of Chicago, Illinois. They're a leading mentoring firm and career management firm that was founded back in 1988. She's going to be talking about the mentoring programs, why they're valuable and important to your organization. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.